Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. It's Black History Month. So this week we have a little history lesson for President Donald Trump. What's next for education under Betsy DeVos now that she's been confirmed as Secretary of Education? And what do Trump's early actions as president tell us about whether he's really going to pick Main Street over Wall Street? All this and more. But first, because we missed him last week, Jeremy Slevin, the Slevs, is back, and I'm sorry, but we couldn't have you around for Galentine's Day.
I know. I was applying, but apparently my application was rejected.
It was rejected, and we had a great time without you. Thanks for asking.
Glad to hear.
we did, though. Female friendship is important.
Yeah, of course. I support Galentine's.
Well, thank you for saying that.
And Galentine's Day.
Thank you for saying all of that. Slevs, there's a lot going on, but in addition to basically everything I just teased, which is the rest of this episode, there's other stuff too.
Yeah.
Help us. Keep track.
Let's start with some good news for a change, because I think it's been pretty down out there, and maybe we can lift people's spirits up. So the good news is that in New York City, low-income tenants, like people who are evicted from their homes, for example, are now guaranteed legal representation, which is a big deal because 90% of them, almost all of them, are forced to represent themselves in court. So say you get evicted, which is obviously a huge driver of poverty, you're now guaranteed a lawyer.
Huge deal, particularly because there is no right to counsel
right.
in civil cases in this country. In criminal cases, because of the famous Gideon versus Wainwright case, you
so
are
famous,
guaranteed
yeah.
a right. Hey, stop it. Come on.
Didn't mean
I
to burst your bubble.
People know
there.
Gideon. There is no right to counsel in civil cases, something that a lot of people don't know and which is not well covered in Law and Order.
Yes.
Thank you very
yeah.
much. Now, I should, one small friendly amendment to what you said. I don't think that people are guaranteed their lawyers in how housing court starting like yet.
Right.
I think this is to come. The
yes.
courts have announced this is happening and that the right to counsel is on its way. Am I wrong about this?
So it's actually a legislation.
Oh, it's
going
legislation.
To guarantee it.
Right, right,
yes,
right.
Yes.
But it hasn't gone into effect yet.
Correct.
So soon.
Correct.
Coming soon, lawyers yeah. for people who need lawyers in housing court in New York City. Very exciting.
Yes. And the mayor just announced his backing for this legislation that's been in the works for a while.
So you know what? Shout out to all of our brothers and sisters in legal aid in New York, because this is a huge deal and we're with you.
Yeah, shout out.
Come on.
All right. We're going to pivot to not so great news.
Of course you are.
We always do. We have to start out positive.
Well, the thought that we would have more than one piece of good news this week was unlikely.
But it's going to be a hard pivot to some really terrible news.
I'm pivoting with you. Take
yeah.
me.
So last weekend, there were immigration raids, deportation raids, rather, across the country in 11 states. 680 people were rounded up and slated for deportation. Now, Trump promised that most of his deportation as president would be targeted towards criminals or gang members or bad hombres, as he called them. It turns out many of these were not criminals. Even ICE, which is Immigration and Customs Enforcement, says that only 75% were criminals.
And their definition of criminal, just to interrupt
right.
you, because
yeah.
you've already given me so much shade that I feel empowered to interrupt you even more than I usually
shade away.
Do. Like, their definition of criminal can also include, and often does, people who have been here undocumented and working with false papers just so they can work.
Yes. One of their quote-unquote gang members was actually rounded up because of an old speeding ticket. So he was charged as a gang member, and his crime, his gang crime, was a speeding ticket.
Did he at least have other people in the car with him?
I don't know. Although it's funny you should mention
gang.
Other people in the car, because the reason that, you know, up to 25% have no criminal records whatsoever is that in these roundups, there's so-called collateral of people who are undocumented but don't have criminal records and are thus rounded up in these raids.
I'm laughing, but it is just completely unconscionable and unspeakable how horrific this is.
Yeah.
And it's heartening how much outrage has been mounting around the attacks on immigrants and their families and their communities. But this is real life, and it's
yeah.
sort of hard to process.
Yeah. And I'll just add, to be like totally to give the whole context, it's unclear if Trump even ordered this. So Immigrations and Customs is saying, oh, this isn't, we've been planning this forever, although it's much larger than what they did under the Obama administration. But Trump is nonetheless claiming credit, saying that, you know, this is gang members, drug dealers, and others are being removed.
Now, of course, another shoe to drop in this, and we talked a little bit about this a couple of weeks ago with one of our guests, was Jose Antonio Vargas. It was another attack on immigrants, a leaked executive order that's floating out there that may, by the time we actually go to air, have already actually been released and signed, but that would make, it would effectively create an income test to enter and to stay in this country. If you're not rich enough for Donald Trump, then he can say, nope, you don't get to come here and reunite with your family. Or, hey, if you commit the crime of turning to public assistance because you fell on hard times, then you could actually be deportable, even if you're here as a legal immigrant.
Yeah. And this has been in the press a lot. And this new executive order could come at any moment.
And may already have come.
Yes, may already have come in parallel radio universe.
Yes. So what else is up?
So here's a holiday coming up, speaking of Galentine's Day. So Thursday, February 16th, was Valentine's Day for millionaires. And that's because February 16th was when millionaires stopped paying for Social Security this year, because there's a cap on the payroll tax where you only have to pay up to what, $118,000?
It's up to $127,000 this year. It increases every year with inflation.
Well, so they're done paying for the year.
They're done for the year. Now, it makes me wonder, when did Donald Trump stop paying in? Oh, wait, we have the answer to that, Jeremy.
Yeah, he stopped paying 40 minutes into the year.
Into New Year's Day. He was done probably before he had even got out his first tweet of the day.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Actually, I was giving him a lot of credit there for spending a lot of time on a tweet.
He was still celebrating New Year's Eve. This is 12:40 a.m. New Year's Day.
Oh, good point. Also, though, peak tweeting hours for him.
Yes. Yeah, so that was fair. It's a little early. Maybe. Yeah, you're right. 3 a.m. was when he got out his first tweet.
So we're laughing about it. I mean, Valentine's Day for millionaires, kind of a cutesy thing, but a big deal, right?
Yeah.
Because actually, as much as conservatives would have the American public believe that Social Security is facing some kind of huge crisis and that the only thing we could do is to massively cut benefits and raise the retirement age and blah, 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 which is their plan for Social Security, as we saw last year in the legislation that they introduced in December, I think it was. The real problem that they're missing and the real story here is actually that rising inequality and that the payroll tax cap basically robbing Social Security of billions of dollars over time, that is taking a huge toll on Social Security's financial health. And if people like Donald Trump and his cabinet would pay in all year round like the rest of us, we wouldn't be having this conversation about Social Security's finances.
And I think it also goes to show how inequality drives so many of our problems. Because one of the reasons that Social Security is even more and more important these days is that so many people don't have adequate retirement savings through their employer. So people are increasingly turning to Social Security. On the other hand, people at the top, the 1%, are increasingly not paying as much into Social Security because they're, you know, the cap is still there and they're earning more and more and not paying into it. So the solution would be to just have them fund Social Security for the people who need it.
And, you know, we could take a page out of President Reagan's book. He actually set the payroll tax cap at what was then 90% of covered wages. It slipped since then to about 82 or 83% of covered wages. And that's why we're missing all of this money that should be coming into the trust funds, and millionaires and billionaires are stopping paying earlier and earlier in the year. I mean, even if we wanted to be, I guess, Republicans about it, we could at least do what Reagan did and bring it back up to 90%.
That would be one simple fix.
So Jeremy, so that we have good news, we had some bad news, we had some millionaires are doing really well. What else is new? Kind of news, but I think we also have some news of our own. Can I get a drum roll? Talk Poverty Radio. We would like to thank our amazing and devoted listeners for the last more than 2 years. You've been with us, and we love you and we appreciate you. And because of the new political climate that we find ourselves in, the new political reality, with the entire world, it seems, off kilter, with the political system off kilter, with real questions about what the future of this country might hold, we are looking to keep pace with the urgency that we feel in this new world. And as a result, we are relaunching and rebranding the show to capture what it is that we're trying to take on. So, Jeremy, I'm excited to bring you into this new world with me, which we are going to call Off Kilter.
Woo! I didn't know we didn't get a drum roll for the name.
Oh, sorry.
I was waiting.
Okay, so maybe we should have done a drum roll there, too. And the name is Off Kilter.
Woo!
To really kind of help capture what's going on and what we feel like we're up against. It's going to be the show that people already know and love, but with an extra dose of resistance, an extra dose of activism, and an extra dose of what you can do in your states, in your communities, to push back, to fight back, and to help make America great again.
But
right?
It's already great.
Except not so much right now after the last month, right?
True.
Feeling like it's slipping away.
We need a better slogan.
I know we do. I'm being tongue-in-cheek. But I think the more that that I talk to people, not just on this show, but in the work that we do and in the fight, people are terrified. People are also activated as shit right now. People are ready to fight back. We saw that with the Women's March. We've seen it with the outrage and momentum around the Muslim ban, around the wall, and it's only going to continue, and we really look forward to being part of that fight. So come with us, Off Kilter. Find us on Facebook. Find us on Twitter at Off Kilter, and we look forward to being there with you in the fight. Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. It's February, which means it's Black History Month. It also happens to be the first full month of the Trump administration, and the resistance is in full swing. Although it's suddenly in full force, this resistance didn't crop up out of nowhere to discuss the long history of protests and boycotts among African Americans, including throughout the years of the Civil Rights Movement. I'm joined by Dr. Blair Kelly. She's an associate professor at North Carolina State University, a professor of history, and she's also the author of Right to Ride: Streetcar Boycotts and the African American Citizenship in the Era of Plessy versus Ferguson. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thanks for having me.
So I would be remiss if I did not acknowledge that not only have we entered a new political era, shall we call it, but that we've entered a political era where the President of the United States doesn't appear to know who Frederick Douglass is, and the Department of Education doesn't appear to know who W.E.B. Du Bois is, or at least how to spell his name when they're tweeting about him for Black History Month. How can we sort of grapple with what's going on as we think about what a meaningful resistance looks like?
I think the frame of new era is an interesting one. It may be a new era in terms of the political style that's engaged by a president. I think it's sort of different in terms of clarity and truth, things like that, and a desire to sort of be transparent. But I'm not so sure that all the dynamics at play are new to us. I think there's always been a general ignorance about African American history. This administration just seems to be demonstrating a profound ignorance of Black history. But I think the idea that Black history is mainstream or understood by most Americans is like a pretty big stretch. Oftentimes I ask my students, if you just sort of walked outside and said, who's Ella Baker? Who's Frederick Douglass? You'd get some not so great answers. So I think this administration is just sort of a reflection of our the ways in which it's okay to ignore African American history for most people and still be considered competent and educated. And Frederick Douglass has been been beat up by sort of Republicans looking for Black Republican origins for a while now. So it was good to see that he's still out there doing work.
So it's one way to put it. So a difference then, not in kind, but in degree, is sort of what you're arguing. So in that event, do you think that there's actually maybe potentially a silver lining to the level of unabashed ignorance of Black history that we're seeing in this administration? Is that actually a teaching opportunity or a learning opportunity for those of us who want to be educated as we resist?
Sure. I do think people who are interested, I think this is a wonderful era for Black history. I think the sort of opening of the History Museum in Washington, D.C. is incredible. It's a resource that this administration hasn't taken advantage of. But they're right there, and they're doing pretty amazing work. So I know that people who are interested in learning more, we have more historians than ever, more people writing really wonderful works, more public historians creating work. So, and I think this is an important moment to mine African American history, a community of people who had to survive hard times, had to go through the unthinkable to try and fight for their citizenship. So the model of African American history is such an important one, as you're saying.
So as we seek to educate ourselves, and maybe there are listeners who would like to know more about the history of resistance as part of civil rights, as part of really in many ways the story of Black history, what are some of the lessons that we should take from resistance movements of years past, including resistance by Black Americans, as we seek to effectively fight back in this new era?
I was surprised in my own journey of becoming an African-American historian, the degree to which there really is no generation of Black people who just accept a bad condition and don't try to fight it. If we look at sort of a popular mainstream reading of the time period I wrote about in my first book, for example, the turn of the 20th century, which I wrote about in Right to Ride, it's said to have been the nadir of African-American history, the lowest point. African-Americans had become free citizens and then lost those rights, suffering under the hands of lynch mobs and those pushing for race riots, those disfranchising state legislatures across the South, also losing their right to the public space. The focus of my book in not being able to ride unsegregated on trains and streetcars, segregation spreads to nearly every aspect of public life. We are taught usually in sort of elementary school that Booker T. Washington was the leader of that day, that he accepted segregation and that most people were Washingtonian and sort of accepted a second-class citizenship and hoped to just get educated and try harder in the future. What I found instead when I began the journey of working on that book was 25 different southern cities had streetcar boycotts and fought against segregation to the nail from the very beginning. Even after the Plessy versus Ferguson decision of 1896, they continued to protest. Plessy versus Ferguson itself is a protest movement, a collective effort to try and stop segregation in Louisiana. The notion that there is any generation that simply accepts second-class treatment is a false one. And the bravery necessary to fight segregation in an age of lynching, in an age of chain gangs, was really profound. And so if they had been silent, it would have been understandable, but they weren't.
So one observation that is often made about resistance movements is that historically, and not all the time, but a lot of the time, there can be a lack of inclusivity within different resistance movements. And I'm particularly reminded of this criticism, and well-deserved criticism, of various resistance movements as we are still very soon, or very recently, on the heels of the Women's March, which mm-hmm. received a tremendous amount of criticism, particularly in the early days of its being organized, for not being diverse, not being inclusive, and frankly, for being very white. So to what extent, in your view, does this remain true today? And more importantly, how do we overcome that challenge and that limitation in resistance?
So when we look at history and we see movements that are really drawing from one single community, they have a harder time. The African Americans that I studied in my first book, they didn't have any allies, really. White allies that had been by their side during the abolition movement began to fall away. People began to grow weary of the idea of allying with African American communities who need continual support. I think it's important for us not to always center our individual experience in protest. I think this moment will call for the broadest coalition possible. When we look at the ways in which people of Muslim descent and who are practicing Muslims today, people who are undocumented, African-Americans, people who live in the sort of quickly dismissed inner city, people who are LGBT, Native communities who are dealing with their struggle against the pipeline in the Midwest. There's so many things happening at the same time. There's so many fronts. If we don't work to understand someone's position beyond our own, we will surely lose. So I think it's a necessary work to find allies, even though that work is hard. It's a necessary work to sort of say, you know, the thing that I am most worried about is not necessarily the only thing.
Now, meanwhile, with the presidential election also fairly recently in the rearview mirror, although it simultaneously to me at least feels both years ago and minutes ago, in not necessarily positive ways. There is sort of a newfound obsession, it seems, with the white working class following the presidential election, and a lot of folks on the left side of the aisle, many of whom are, you know, actively engaged in resistance, either inside the Beltway or across the country, asking the question of how do we appeal to people and communicate with people and reach people and communities who have felt left behind, many of whom are so-called white working class, many of whom are not. But how do we do that without whitewashing our message in the process? And I don't know if you have feelings or thoughts or guidance there.
I think it's really incredible the degree to which we use the idea of a working class as a white male space, right? Probably the most working class people in this country are women of color, right? In terms of the raw demographics of them. And yet we never worry if they recovered from the sort of economic crisis of 2008. We never really worry if they recover any wealth they had in their homes or in their communities. We never frame those things out for them. And I think that it's the lie of race. I mean, race is a lived, real experience, but a lie in that it's designed to disguise the unity that working people would have in this country if not being told that sort of a white experience is normative and everyone else's experiences aren't. I think that that's the lie of history. Bacon's Rebellion, 100 years before the American Revolution, was a unifying of indigenous and enslaved and African descendants and white indentures who saw in each other common cause. And so ideas were planted to undo that, and they've been quite effective. And so part of what our work must be is to stop the lie that there's somehow something fundamentally different about a white working class and a black working class and a Latino working class, and that their interests would be so diametrically opposed, as opposed to the interests of a working class against a billionaire and his friends.
Well, in that same moment, though, as you describe how people in many cases have more in common than they have that's different, there is a reality that many of us who do this work and who are seeking to communicate effectively about policies and about political choices, there is a reality that we run up against, which is that the same words can mean different things to different people. And to that end, I'm incredibly curious if you have feelings or thoughts about how to communicate to people who are workers in a language that speaks to them and that doesn't sound like code for white.
I think it's important to talk about the kinds of ways in which stability has been created over time in this country and really made it a really strong country in the past, where people could educate their kids, could have sort of a basic stability in their home, could retire in dignity, could receive medical care. The things that people need to just sort of get by day by day, plus the things that they deserve, as we think of sort of a human rights framework. And I think we've gotten to the point where we now pretend as though if I get health care, then somehow that's a diminution of what you get. That if my kid gets into college, somehow that's taking away. That if my neighbor has legal status, then somehow that's stealing a job that I wanted. We start to stop thinking of things as sort of a zero-sum game and help to educate people that there's enough here to make sure that we are humane. There's enough here. But we have to really be honest about the degree to which that's hard work, right? So during the campaign, I thought it was interesting when Bernie Sanders would point to Norwegian countries or Scandinavian countries as sort of like a model for how socialism might work here. They have a sort of a power because they consider their neighbor to be related to them and connected to them by descent. In this country, we're so worried that someone black or brown might get something that we're standing in the pit, as Martin Luther King used to say, if you're too busy about putting your foot on my neck, then you don't realize you're standing in the pit with me. We have to get to the work of recognizing where we all stand relative to the powers in this country, and really sort of demand a basic treatment, for basic education, basic health care, those things that the Obama administration started a conversation about are still necessary, and we have to grow what we've done, not rip it apart. But I think it's interesting that this, the folks in this administration who have to draw on the language of a whiteness and a white nationalism to make it work. It's telling. It's the tell of this whole experiment. It's the grand distraction. And so we have to call that out where we see it and do the work of making other people understand that we are each other's neighbor and each other's keeper.
In the last minute or so that I have with you, you are a professor who teaches courses on African American history, African American women's history, on civil rights and more. For activists and organizers and folks out there who want to know more so that they can not just be educated, but they can learn lessons from past and successful and landmark resistance movements, what would you recommend that folks be reading?
Anyone that doesn't know who Ella Baker is, they need to start to know who she is. An amazing reminder that movement is constant. A great book about Ella Baker is by another organizer, a woman named Barbara Ransby. I'd suggest that people look at the work of Manning Marable. This is a book called The Great Wells of Democracy that's really, I think, quite hopeful and thoughtful. I think people should get to know Dr. King a little bit better, given that he's always so used by the right as a baton on our heads, that somehow King wouldn't want this. His published papers are being put out volume by volume. Any one of those, a dive into those, is so incredible to really get to know a resistant King, a King who made no peace with inequality, who made no peace with injustice and unjust law. I could go on, but it's going to take a while.
Well, we appreciate it, and I know as a nerd, I always appreciate recommendations as to what I should be reading, so we'll make sure to get that up on our site and to tweet that out when this episode goes to air.
I think also reading about Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells, given that Frederick Douglass was so maligned recently, would be incredible, and there's a lot of really great work. Even his own words are so important.
Hopefully the president listens to the show and knows that he needs to do a little bit of reading. Dr. Blair Kelly is a professor of history at North Carolina State University. She is also the author of Right to Ride, Streetcar Boycotts, and African American Citizenship in the Era of Plessy versus Ferguson. Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Betsy DeVos has been confirmed as Secretary of Education of the United States, but it's not just grizzly bears anymore. The real work begins. So to help me unpack what DeVos's confirmation as Education Secretary means for education policy and our nation's students, I've got with me Catherine Brown. She's the Vice President of Education and Related Things here at the Center for American Progress. Catherine, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here on Talk Poverty Radio.
So I'm making light of things. I mentioned the grizzly bear piece. There were a lot of entertaining moments in the last several weeks leading up to DeVos's confirmation, but it wasn't all entertainment. I mean, there's actually a lot of, we should be appropriately serious here. Remind us, who is Betsy DeVos? What's her background? What do we know about her?
That's right, Rebecca. I mean, a lot of us in the education policy community watched in horror during her confirmation hearing. It wasn't entertaining at all to see that she really didn't know basic information about education policy and some of the most important laws that govern our schools in our country, like the Individuals for Disabilities in Education Act. She's definitely an outside the beltway choice. She's been a lobbyist for school vouchers for most of her career in education. She's a billionaire, and she has served on the board of the American Federation of Children, and in that role served as a philanthropist and invested tremendous amounts of money in state legislator races and advocacy campaigns, mostly designed at privatizing public schools. She's never managed a large organization. She's never worked in public schools. She's never sent her children to public schools. She herself has never attended public schools. So she is really an unusual selection for this job of overseeing our nation's public school system.
Unusual being a diplomatic word. I commend you for toning down a lot of the things I'm sure you could have said. But you mentioned a few threads there. I'm not going to focus so much on the pay to play allegations, her family's wealth, and, you know, did she effectively buy this position? I'm not going to focus on kind of some of those aspects, although they have been raised and there are serious allegations there. But I do want to focus on some of the policy positions that either she has taken or that we believe from her background she may take. So you mentioned vouchers, and I want to start there. It's a word that gets thrown around in a lot of contexts, including in the education conversation and debate. But help us understand, what is the voucher proposal when it comes to education policy? Who does it potentially help? Who would lose out? Give us the background.
Yeah, I mean, vouchers take a lot of different forms, so it's a good question that you're asking. At its base, what a voucher policy is money that either goes to parents, to children themselves, to corporations, or to individuals who are funding what are often called scholarship programs. And they allow students to take those resources and exit the public school system and go to a private school. That's really what we're talking about here. They're often framed as a way to help students from low-income communities who are zoned for failing schools to exit and go to higher performing schools. But what we've seen from the research is, A, they don't actually lead students who get the vouchers to go to higher performing schools. That's been found overwhelmingly over decades of research on these policies. And what they do is leave schools that have higher concentrations of kids living in poverty, kids with disabilities, kids with special needs, stuck in higher need public school systems. So, overall, the people that they really disadvantage are exactly the students that the rhetoric would lead you to believe that they're helping.
And they often get framed as about school choice. It's providing families, providing students with choice. Are there concerns about what the sort of macro results would be, not just the students who get left behind, but what a scaled up voucher policy could mean for our public education system writ large?
Absolutely. And, I think one of the other concerns that doesn't get raised enough is the fact that private schools don't have the same civil rights laws and the same responsibilities to serve kids with special needs. So, for example, private schools select the students that attend their schools. They can say, no, we're not going to have this student. And that often is going to be the students that are coming from more disadvantaged backgrounds that have greater needs. They don't often have special services to support those kids. And they can expel kids if they have behavioral problems or other issues. So what you're left with is a system that is, abandoning the kids who most need to have a high quality option because that is their chance at succeeding in life.
While pretending to be a policy that helps those students.
Exactly.
You also mentioned the IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is a federal law, which, if in case Secretary DeVos is listening, will help her understand what it is, a federal law that ensures, it actually requires that all students in this country, including students with disabilities, are entitled to a free and appropriate public education, just like all other students, sometimes called a FAPE, free and appropriate public education, to help Betsy DeVos remember that one next time she's asked about it. So what might DeVos's confirmation and her leadership at the Department of Education mean for students with disabilities in this country?
Well, I think that's a great question, and we did not get a lot of insights into how she would handle this particular enforcement of this incredibly important law, which, as you say, is one of the most major education laws in this country. It serves 6.5 million children, provides $11 billion a year in education funding. She didn't know that it was actually a set of requirements that was not optional. What she said at her hearing is that she thought states could decide whether or not to enforce the IDEA Act. I think that comes from her advocacy in vouchers, because the other thing we know about vouchers, which I should have mentioned earlier, is that students with disabilities often have to sign away their rights that are protected under IDEA when they sign up for a voucher program, and it can be kind of insidious. Sometimes the districts don't make clear that you're signing away your rights when you enter this program. So I think that's the view that she's taking when she's thinking about IDEA, but it's really troublesome because there are millions of students that rely on these protections for a free and appropriate public education, as you say, they're likely to get left behind under her vision, though we don't really know. I mean, she was very unclear about what she was going to do when she became Secretary of Education. She was very evasive.
And it's worth doing a little bit of a getting in a time machine for a moment and thinking back to what education looked like for students with disabilities before the IDEA was in place. I know if we had a number of my friends and colleagues in the disability community here speaking with us right now, that many of them would actually recount personal experiences and experiences of their parents and of their colleagues in literally being denied education, being told that they could not actually attend school, not being mainstreamed, not being put in classes where that they would be more than capable of performing right alongside other students, but instead being treated differently and being effectively segregated out of public education in this country. And that's what Betsy DeVos appears completely unaware of.
That's right. One of my first exposures to this was I worked for then Senator Hillary Clinton when she was a senator from New York. And she often would tell the story about her first job out of law school when she worked for the Children's Defense Fund. And she worked in New Bedford, Massachusetts. And one of the things that she did was to walk door to door, interview families, and identify parents of kids with disabilities and try to reconcile why were there more kids living in these communities than there were enrolled in the schools. And the differential was students with disabilities who were systematically being told by their schools, oh, we can't serve you. Oh, your needs are too great. Oh, we can't help you. And often these were kids in wheelchairs or kids with physical disabilities that had absolute, you know, high abilities to fulfill their potential if they could just make accommodations in the physical facility. And so IDEA has made a huge difference in those kids' lives. We know that those kids now have access, are required to have access to a free, high quality education. And we've seen tremendous improvements in their outcomes even in the last 15 years.
So another issue that has been at the forefront of the education debate nationally has been student debt. We've surpassed national records when it comes to the amount of debt for higher education that American students now hold. It, for many people, can be the difference between being able to actually move out of their parents' house after college and go out and get a job and become, you know, something resembling an adult. It stops people from, you know, getting married, starting families. We're really reaching crisis proportions when it comes to the student debt crisis in this country. What do we think a Secretary DeVos is going to do when it comes to student loan policy?
Well, that's a great question. It's another area where she was very evasive during her hearing. What we do know is that she's held stakes in companies that receive contracts from the Department of Ed to pursue and collect loans of defaulted student loan borrowers. She's invested in a company called SoFi that profited off of the student loan crisis by refinancing federal student loans into private loans. During her confirmation hearing, she wouldn't commit to using the many tools and resources of Ed to protect students from fraud, nor would she commit to defending the public student loan forgiveness program, which allows students to have to pay back only a certain percentage of their income when they're earning, you know, a lower income salary for working in a nonprofit or public sector job. So I think there's reason to be very concerned, and there's reason to think that her orientation towards student loans is on the side of the banks that President Obama did such a fantastic job getting out of the student loan business. I'm deeply concerned that we're going to see it put right back in there.
Now, I said I wasn't going to bring up the pay-to-play stuff, but I lied because I do think that there is a reason to ask questions about sort of some of where her interests might lie. And so where I do want to take us in the last minute or so that I have with you is, given that we have reliable information that political donations made by DeVos's family may have played a role in her selection and ultimately in her confirmation as Secretary of Education, do we have reason to believe that any of her holdings or that any of her financial interests may motivate any of her decision making? And if so, in what direction? I feel like you started to get there in your last answer now that she's in this post.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's no question that Betsy DeVos wouldn't have been a credible candidate for Secretary of Education if her family hadn't donated upwards of $200 million to the GOP. She wrote an op-ed that was actually published in the late 90s that said, we are the largest donor to the Republican Party, and I've stopped pretending that we don't expect something in return. We absolutely expect something in return. So credit to her for honesty. At least she's clear about what her pay for play looks like. And I think what this means is, you know, given her holdings in student loans, you hit on this important topic. I think she'll lean towards the banks. I think we know that. She used to have holdings in for-profit charter schools. And in Michigan, where she had the greatest impact on education policy, we see a huge differential in for-profit charters versus nonprofit charters. 80% of charter schools in Michigan are for-profit. The national average, for a comparison point, is 13%. So this is extraordinary. And these are schools that are, you know, looking at their bottom line when they're deciding how to educate kids, how to expand, how to recruit and retain students. So it's all very concerning. And, you know, hopefully we'll, through all the great work that's going on, continue to hold her accountable. I think the on the bright side, there's a lot of focus on what she's doing, and she's not going to be able to put these regulations or take regulations that have been in place out without a fight from citizens and from student loan borrowers and from others.
So the IDEA may be Greek to Betsy DeVos, but maybe her Latin is better and she knows quid pro quo. I've been speaking with Catherine Brown. She is the Vice President of Education Policy here at the Center for American Progress. And we will certainly be watching closely in the months ahead to see what Betsy DeVos is going to do as Secretary of Education. Catherine, thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me, Rebecca.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. Following a campaign throughout which he claimed to be the head of a supposed workers' party, President Trump has repeatedly pledged to give power back to the people. And many struggling workers placed their bets on him last November to improve their economic circumstances. But what do his first actions as president say about whether he's keeping those promises? I'm joined by Mike Konzel, a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute and author of a recent New York Times column titled Trump Picks Wall Street Over Main Street to help us figure that out. Mike, thanks so much for joining the show.
Thanks for having me back.
And I should say, yes, for coming back to the show. Yes, you remember you were on the show.
Yeah, I had a great time and I'm excited to be on this one again.
Well, so Mike, help us start to take a look at this. It's not just promises anymore. We're actually starting to see President Trump take actions as president instead of just giving a lot of speeches. What are some of his early actions that we should be looking at, and what do they tell us about whether he's fighting for workers?
Sure. So I think President Trump was really benefited during the campaign, both in the primary and the general election, by not having a detailed policy record. He didn't have any moments where he had to make really hard decisions about who to prioritize, what interests to focus on. And so a lot of people were able to read things into him. And, you know, you had an election where, you know, you had numbers like 70 or 80% of people wanted a change candidate. And so I think a lot of people read into the idea that he would be very tough on Wall Street. He used a lot of language like draining the swamp, pointed out criticisms of the ties between Goldman Sachs and Wall Street and the Democratic Party, and did a lot of things to convey that he might be tougher on the control of finance and, you know, the real inequality that goes on there than the Democratic candidates or the other Republican candidates. And I think since the election, you can focus on three things. You can look at his appointments. You can look at some of the initial actions Congress has taken. You can look at several executive orders he's just done to show that that's not going to pan out for working people.
So he, in the last 3 weeks, it feels like a hell of a lot longer at this point that we've been surviving so far in this administration. But over the course of about 3 weeks, he has signed a whole flurry of executive orders, leveraging executive authority to make policy or to direct his federal agencies as part of his administration to do various things. And a couple of the recent executive orders that he has signed, as you describe in this op-ed that you had in the New York Times, really cut straight to the heart of this question of whose side is he really on? Is it Wall Street or is it Main Street, as the title of your piece sort of points to? So, verdict?
So it's definitely going to be in favor of Wall Street. And I think—
Well, we knew that from the title, right?
We knew this, but I think it's telling how we're going to know this, right? So there's, the initial appointments, most of the high-level economic policymaking is coming from Goldman Sachs, people who either directly worked at it, like his National Economic Council chair, people who had worked to it recently, as in his Treasury Secretary, or people even like Steve Bannon, who had worked at Goldman Sachs at some point in the past. So I think we don't know the last number, but I think it's just two or three short of a softball team number of people who are in senior economic policymaking roles who had some experience in deep senior experience with Goldman Sachs. That tells us right away. Now, maybe a lot of his fans and a lot of supporters will say, well, he needs that expertise to really get to the rod and really, you know, drain the swamp. People who know how broken the system is to fix it. That was actually part of Donald Trump's whole campaign, was the idea that he knew how the corruption works so he could fix it.
Because who better to drain the swamp than the alligators who live there?
Exactly, right? And you can understand why some people might say, wow, so, you know, he bragged about how he bought everyone and so he knows how to unbuy them and so forth. However, the initial actions we're seeing, the executive orders you just discussed, point in the opposite direction. He released two executive orders. One of them was just basically to do a review of Dodd-Frank. And I don't think we want to overestimate what can be done through executive action. Dodd-Frank, which we'll talk about in a few minutes, is a robust, smart piece of legislative accomplishment that won't easily be undone. But he did two things. One was to call for a review of the Department of Labor's fiduciary rule. This basically prevents middle-class people and working-class people from having their retirements be advised by people who do not have their best interests at heart. The last time these kinds of guidelines were updated was 1975, so before 401ks, before the internet. And it was a very long thought out, heavily debated process. I'm not sure if you guys covered it in the past, but it's been very well debated. And the rule was come to with a lot of, nuance and technicalities to make sure it didn't disrupt the system. Donald Trump put that up front, and that is such an industry demand. That is not some arcane thing that's not working for people. It definitely is going to work for people. It's not some, oversight or something that's not relevant for people. This is something directly where the interests of the donor class, the Republican Party, and middle class people don't coincide, and he chose to fight for Wall Street in this case.
Well, I want to go back to Dodd-Frank for a second. So I feel like in any discussion about Wall Street and about sort of financial regulatory reform, right, and also in people reflecting on what caused the crash and the Great Recession, you hear a lot of last names. You hear Dodd-Frank, you hear Glass-Steagall. But what are these names? What are the laws that they actually describe? And maybe help us tell the story of why we needed this reform in the first place?
Absolutely. So in 2008, there was a giant financial crisis. Lehman Brothers went into failure, which dragged down the rest of the financial sector. And there had to be large backstopping and bailouts to kind of get everything under control. There was also a wave of foreclosures, over 6 million foreclosures, certainly maybe even as high as 8 or 10 million. The fact that we don't know how many numbers there was is very, very telling, starting in 2008. And so to deal with the aftermath of that crisis, to make sure banks were better capitalized, to segment out some of the riskier activities, to make sure that there was a mechanism to allow a bank to fail, Congress, the Democrats in 2010, passed a bill called Dodd-Frank, named after Barney Frank and Chris Dodd, their representative shepherds in the House and Senate. Dodd-Frank does not have, and I'll talk about one in a second, but it's not as easy to explain because a lot of it's technical and a lot of it's in the background. But it has done a lot to make sure banks are better funded, to the detriment of their profits, but to the betterment of society as a whole. And also, I think crucially for Talk Poverty, has a dedicated consumer financial protection agency, something called the CFPB. Before Dodd-Frank, consumer protection was split among 10 or 12 different agencies, and it was always the third priority, which is to say it was nobody's priority to look out for everyday Americans. And you had a lot of regulators who actually thought if banks were making money, even at expensive people through deceptive and bad practices, it made them healthier and stronger. And so they would override state attorney generals and override other people trying to do protection. So they made then Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren, now Senator Elizabeth Warren's brainchild. And it's been a great agency. And it is, of course, one of the things most in Republicans' crosshairs.
So now back to the fiduciary rule, which was the second of the two executive orders that you just walked through. It sounds very complicated. With a name like fiduciary rule, I think people often go like, what does that have to do with my life, right? But what it really is about preventing conflicts of interest, as you were describing, by people who are handling retirement investments. So tell us a little bit about the future of that executive order, as well as the other, both of which are effectively directing reviews. What can we expect in the next weeks, months ahead? What's the process that we should be watching for that these executive orders can kick off?
Absolutely. So there's going to be an overall set of reviews, and there are some things they can attack. But I think it's very useful for your audience, especially for Talk Poverty, to know some of the initial things that are going to go out the door are so anti-consumer and so pro-bank. So you have the fiduciary rule, which in some sense is complicated, but in a very core sense, it's not. It's whether or not your investment manager can try to rip you off or give you advice that is not in your best interest, that they believe is not in your best interest.
Which could enrich them.
Which would enrich them directly. They're going to try to attack it. It's not clear if they can get a lot, if they can directly attack it, they can try to delay it. But the fact that that is in their crosshairs tells you whose side they are on. Congress, through some technicalities that has to do with rules written at the end of a presidential term, is about to vote to undo debit card regulations, particularly the overdraft fees on prepaid debit cards, which is something that is used by underbanked communities They're very aggressive fees. And basically, the CFPB put in a rule saying basically you have to go high road with this. You can't rip off consumers with debit cards. It's very important for poor communities, communities of color. Congress, the Republican Congress, just voted to undo that. That tells you whose side they're on, right? This is not the swamp. This is giving something that is their donor class a gimme at the expense of poor communities. And the third thing they're going to do is try to go after that Consumer Financial Protection Bureau we talked about earlier. They're going to try to do it through its funding stream. Like a lot of things that go on, right, in the next couple of years, the Republicans will focus very heavily on what they can undo through something called budget reconciliation, which will only require 50 votes in the Senate and can be done through party line votes. And one thing they can probably do is try to mess with the CFPB's funding and basically say, you're doing such a good job defending consumers and going after, you know, fraudsters and deceptive practices. We're going to defund you until the Democrats agree to change your regulations, which would cost 60, which would need 60 votes. It's a sneaky way to do it, but something they'll legally be able to do. Now, whether or not they'll have 50 votes for it depends a lot on activism. And I think this is something that you can explain to people is important, does good work, and we shouldn't repeal it.
Now, in the course of telling the American people that somehow Dodd-Frank is something that they need to be protected from, Trump's administration alludes to concerns that we apparently should have about international competitiveness of our banks. Is that a pretext? Is there something there that we should actually be worrying about? And if so, is this the right way to go about addressing that concern?
Sure. So, you know, they're going to argue that the Obama team's response to the financial crisis was so overwhelming and so nanny-state, it did not do anything to solve problems, and that it is costing us too much credit. It's basically making it hard for banks to lend, hard for consumers to borrow. We certainly don't see that in the aggregate stats. Lending has continued up. I mean, it obviously fell apart in 2009, 2010 at the height of the Great Depression and the aftermath of the financial crisis, but it has since recovered to normal levels. When you do polls of small businesses, they say access to credit is not their problem. Their problem is, you know, just finding customers for their things and also hiring people, which is not on the lending side at all. When you talk to loan officials, they say that, you know, their surveys say that this isn't a real detriment on them. So at the margins, you can say maybe lending's tightened a little bit, but that's also a good idea. One thing the CFPB does is make it require extra checks to do something like a subprime loan, to say that if a bank does do a subprime loan, it has extra requirements, extra due diligence, and takes on extra legal responsibility in a way it doesn't if it's a high road better mortgage, which I think is really important, right? Because we know subprime is such an important role in the housing bubble and the housing and the subsequent crash. When we look at it in aggregate, we don't see that that's not the real problem. The real problem, as we know, has been weak demand, a sluggish recovery, you know, concentration, inequality, things that are not on the lending side.
Now, on the fiduciary rule, backing up, another debate that has been going on at full speed in the last several weeks has been Republicans and Trump's quest to repeal the Affordable Care Act, or the ACA. And they've come to tell us that they aren't just going to repeal it, they're also going to replace it. We don't know with what, neither do they. We'll see if they ever figure that out. Meanwhile, Trump, is he claiming that he wants to replace the fiduciary rule and those protections with something else, and is that even really something feasible to do?
He's definitely not saying he's going to replace it with something else. And I think that's actually a really great point to bring up, is that it would be one thing if they had a different idea for how to handle the problems that the financial sector poses to the rest of the economy. It's huge growth, it's huge profitability, and it's huge risks. It was shown to have in 2008. If there was an alternative discussion, that would be one thing you could compromise on and maybe take the best of both ideas. They live in a reality where there is no problem, or the only problem is that Wall Street is not bigger, that it has too much accountability. That's not the reality of everyday working Americans. I think we're going to see this unfold in the next couple of years when they unilaterally try to weaken the you know, basic protections that were put in place after the crisis without replacing it with anything else.
In the last minute or so that I have with you, aside from these two executive orders and what we can expect to come in the weeks and months ahead as part of the process that they've kicked off, what, as you look in your crystal ball, magic eight ball, not sure which you keep in your pocket, what do we expect that these early actions out of Trump's administration portend for how he's going to handle the financial sector?
So I think there's going to be two avenues that we should watch. One is enforcement. He's going to appoint people that he already has and will continue to appoint people who have no interest in holding Wall Street accountable. Senator Jeff Sessions is going to spend his time going after civil rights activists, not going after financial crimes. It's really unfortunate, but that's going to be the reality of it. His Federal Reserve and other regulators will not try to bring big fines or criminal convictions or other kinds of serious consequences for bad dealings. That's really bad, but that's the reality of it, and that's what we're going to deal with. On the other hand, I think they're going to try to use the budget mechanism to mess with as much of Dodd-Frank as possible in the same way they're going to do with the ACA. And like the ACA, they're not going to have replacements, and they're not going to even have a real theory of what they want to do. And as a result, they're going to cause a lot of chaos and a lot of damage for working people without any upside or benefit to them.
Mike Konzol is a fellow with the Roosevelt Institute. Check out his op-ed in the New York Times titled "Trump Picks Wall Street Over Main Street." And Mike, I look forward to having you back on the show when it is off kilter.
Thank you very much.
And that's the show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. You can find us anytime at www.talkpoverty.org/podcast, where we have a full archive of all past shows. You can also listen to us anytime as a podcast on iTunes. And send us your pitches to info@talkpoverty.org. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring in the dough. And none of those could connect me with the HMO. And nowadays it's common for grandparents to outlive their grandkids. And those are the type of odds that we handling. I'm not a slave to a man with a whip. I'm a slave to the U.S. men. And they got me doing things in my life that never made any sense. But it paid me in dollars and cents. I need the money for the food, the health care, the schools and bus fare. You can't pay the rent without the U.S. right there. With shackles on my hands and toes, they got a brother moving slow, but my soul is determined to go. I want freedom. Freedom. Now I don't know where it's at, but it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the map. We just trying to get freedom.